Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a great question, Lauren.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the second half of my conversation with Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West. If you haven't listened to the first half of our conversation, you can do so at mtpr.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. In that first half of our conversation, Amy and I talked about the major players in this land dispute, this dispute over a proposed wind farm. And we talked a bit about the history of land ownership in that area. Let's get back to it. We're going to drop in on Amy talking about the complicated way the land in the shadow of the Crazy Mountains is divided. This is a little refresher before we continue on. This is Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies.
And it's an enormous source of frustration for many people in Montana who love the Crazies and would like to hike there and hunt there. You just can't get to them. They are extremely inaccessible. And it kind of adds to the whole mystique about them and to the mirage-like quality, I would argue, because like they're there, but you can't get to them. It's like this vision of something amazing and inaccessible. There are, I think, only two main roads, and they're not even real roads. They're like rutted dirt roads into the mountains. So the history of the West is very much enmeshed in the current conflicts that we're seeing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, between public and private land, and certainly the tension between working cattle ranchers and ranches like the one Rick Jarrett owned, and, you know...
Yeah, and members of the public, too, I would say.
And members of the public, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. People who want to utilize this space but are blocked from doing so by other people like Russell Gordy, their want for privacy. You mentioned this idea, Amy, that Rick Jarrett, Alfred Anderson, even Marty Wilde, their idea for the wind farm, their motivations for it, were not environmentally minded. They weren't thinking about this landscape or this wind farm in terms of combating climate change. They weren't thinking about the need for renewable energy. They're thinking, as were most of the residents of Big Timber, many of the folks who lived in this area or live in this area, about how the wind farm can benefit them financially. It's a bit self-serving and, as we've already talked about, legacy-driven. I'm wondering what role environmentalism, that kind of activism even, I'm wondering about what role you thought it might play in the story before you wrote it or even researched it, what role it plays in this story, in your mm-hmm. conceptualization of it, and where it fits sort of on the ground in this area, on this landscape.
So Marty was a businessman, first and foremost. He never talked about climate change, greenhouse gases. He said that stuff was above his pay grade. He was there to make money. And in fact, he was only doing what a developer would need to do in order to get projects like this wind farm permitted and to secure power purchase agreements from the powers that be, notably the Public Service Commission, which is a body that oversees all monopoly utilities, including your main provider of electricity, Northwestern Energy. And Marty always knew better than to go into a PSC hearing talking about the green benefits of a project he was promoting, because the only thing that the PSC commissioners wanted to hear about was cost effectiveness. And there was no place within that body for discussions about anything that didn't have to do with consumers' pocketbooks. It was the same dynamic at county commission meetings at Big Timber in Sweetgrass County. Big Timber, I should point out, is one of the reddest dots on the red map of Montana. It is a solidly Republican county. And I believe the last time Big Timber in Sweetgrass County went blue was for FDR. So that's going back a ways. So again, you know, when Rick and Marty are making their case, they know that it's almost going to be a mark against them, given how politicized climate change discussions and green energy has become. They know it's almost going to be a mark against them if that's what they go in there talking about. So instead, they talk about how it's going to increase tax revenue for the county and pay for the schools and the roads and do all kinds of good things for the people of the community. And I will just say, you know, since we're talking about environmental benefits, the issue is not so clear cut with this wind farm. There were definite strikes against it because this location of where Rick's Ranch happens to be is a major migratory pathway for all kinds of raptors and other birds and a favorite habitat of golden eagles and bald eagles. It has, I think, one of the largest concentrations of eagles of anywhere. And so eagles don't really do well with wind farms. And so, you know, there was real concern, legitimate concern from environmentalists about whether this wind farm was in the right place, let's say, and whether the benefits outweighed the risks.
So Marty Wild has this idea for a wind farm. He goes to Rick Jarrett and then subsequently down the line to the Andersons. He wants to lease their land. And you have on the other end of this, or on the other side of this dispute, these millionaires and billionaires who don't want this wind farm to be built, who don't want it to happen. This is, Amy, such a complicated story, not only because you have these differing perspectives, these differing motivations, these people whose relationships to the land are very, very different, whether that's the way they occupy the land, whether they're working it, but because of the administrative and bureaucratic stuff that's going on in the background. I mean, you mentioned the Public Service Commission, their meetings in Big Timber. You know, I don't know that I have a specific question, except that maybe you can speak towards those motivations or those tensions. Take that where you want to go.
So here's the thing. Every person in this conflict was coming from a good place. They were coming from a love for this land. I really believe that. But how they saw the land, like what they saw when they looked at this landscape, was so different for each one of them. And what preserving it and what made, you know, what was in the best interests of this landscape, that those ideas were also conflicting, right? So for someone like Rick Jarrett, the scenery took a back seat to being able to continue a traditional way of life on this land. I think most people would agree that cattle ranching is a big part of Montana's Western identity, and we don't want to see those ranchers disappear and get replaced by subdivisions and little nice ranchettes for Easterners to own for vacation properties. So he was looking at the landscape pragmatically. He always was looking at its resources as something he could tap and use. You know, when he looked at the mountains, he didn't see a beautiful picture postcard. He saw snowpack, and snowpack meant water. And water meant, was he going to be able to irrigate his hay fields and feed his cows in the summer? Now, for somebody like a Russell Gordy or Whitney McMillan, you know, they are seeing this extraordinary, irreplaceable landscape that once it is gone, can never be gotten again. In fact, one of the one of the fellow litigants in this struggle, a guy named Jan Angus, who made his fortune in the rock blasting business and buys his little piece of paradise on the Yellowstone. He used a word to describe the land. He said, it's made of unobtainium, if you will. Once you have, it can never be obtained again. Once you lose this land, it will never be obtained again because it's irreplaceable. So they saw almost like, you know, you could put a picture frame around it. You know, this is a perfect, beautiful, pristine thing, and we must absolutely leave it as it is. So they all have their own ideas of what it means to love this landscape. And, you know, who's right in the end? The answer shouldn't be a simple one. And I hope that when people are reading the book, which jumps from perspective to perspective, I try to get you in the heads of each one of these extremely complicated and fascinating people. I hope that when you are reading the story from their perspective, that you kind of find yourself on their side, that you're seduced by them, that you fall in love with them a little bit, because I did as I was writing it. There are perhaps not a lot of simple answers here, but there is a very big problem. And I think that is something that goes beyond the scope of you know, one lawsuit over a proposed wind development. It's an issue about the way that enormous wealth can shape outcomes, that the way it can influence local governments and the courts and scoop out traditional communities from the inside and kind of remake them in a way that's almost invisible from the outside. And that is something that's happening in beautiful places across the West, largely kind of below the radar. And I think it's something that we all should be very concerned about.
Amy, you're a journalist, but this book feels like a piece of, and I'll use this word again, activism in that very sense. It feels like a cry. Everyone, this is happening. See this problem. Know this is happening. How does a community like Big Timber, say, or a person like Rick Jarrett, or even his daughter, Jamie Jarrett, like, how do they fight against a billionaire? In one sense, that's the question at the heart of this book, right? This David and Goliath narrative, maybe? But in your research, is there a way where communities as small as Big Timber or as large as Bozeman, Montana, can fight against billionaires?
You know, there's been a lot of talk in the last few months about the rise of the American oligarchy. And, you know, we're seeing that play out in a very dramatic and public way in Washington right now with a unelected appointee with enormous wealth, the richest man on the planet, basically reshaping our government. And I would argue that this is actually happening kind of off camera as well. And that if an Elon Musk represents the kind of hard power of a billionaire, there is also a soft power of enormous wealth to reshape and alter the dynamics of established communities. And the force of that, I am not sure any one person can counter. Let me give you an example. So when Rick Jarrett's neighbors decided that they were going to stop him from building a wind farm, the law was basically on his side. In Montana, property rights are paramount. You know, you can do what you want with your land. You know, if you want to, you know, frack it, you can. And in fact, people have. There are few zoning rules in Sweetgrass County. There are zoning rules that affect, you know, the immediate municipal limits of Big Timber. But beyond that, it's pretty much, you know, it's your land. You can do what you want with it. I would say it's almost an article of faith in some communities, you know, that is sacrosanct. And so he should have been able to do what he wanted on his private land. But in fact, his neighbors were able to shape public opinion, first of all, by, by kind of flooding the zone, if you will, by, you know, hiring lobbyists to create a fake grassroots campaign to save the crazy mountains. This was an AstroTurf campaign that, you know, that looked like it was, you know, just regular folks, but in fact had been created, by a lobbyist somewhere. They're able to hire lawyers and to file lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit and appeal after appeal and keep something tied up in litigation, which in its own way is like the death of a thousand cuts. So they can do that too. And I think for the county commissioners in Sweetgrass County, who Republican to a one, you know, very conservative, and not keen on wind developments. But they saw this as a question of private property rights. And they also saw it as an economic benefit for their county because they were going to get millions of dollars in tax revenues if this wind farm was built. And they were very frustrated because, you know, they would have a meeting scheduled about the wind farm and a lawsuit would be filed. And then the meeting would have to get canceled while they examined this lawsuit. And, you know, the county attorney is having to, you know, juggle these assaults coming almost nonstop, preventing the county really from just conducting business. So I think, you know, I wish there was someone at some point uses the term David and Goliath battle. I kind of use that tongue in cheek. I would not apply those words to this story. But, you know, you're talking about people who are going up against forces that are so much bigger than one ranching family or even one ranching community. And it's really, given the system and the way it operates now, it's hard to know if there could have been a different outcome. You know, I don't want to give too much away here, but... you know, we are living in a new era of enormous wealth. And this is a great time for the billionaires out there because they are able to not just buy lots of pretty things and beautiful ranches and yachts and planes and whatever, but they are able to condition reality. They can condition their own reality so that they never have to look at anything ugly or smell anything bad. And in a community like Big Timber, they are conditioning the reality of their neighbors as well, even if the neighbors don't fully realize it.
You're listening to A Conversation with Amy Gammerman. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapter1bookstore.com. I want to talk about what I'll call your writing style. And I'll also say that it's both a singular voice and a polyvocal book. It maintains a journalistic distance for the most part. There are a couple moments in there where you bring the singular I in there, but there are hundreds of moments throughout wherein you sort of adopt the voice and sometimes the swagger, I'll call it, of these characters. Talk about that choice, how you came up with that idea, how you implemented it. It feels so subtle, but very intentional. Talk about that.
Well, you know, it all goes back to this extraordinary landscape, these extraordinary mountains, and the sheer physical charisma that these mountains exert, you know, their magnetism. And I felt like the key to understanding the conflict, part of it was in understanding what unique set of life events and life histories had brought each one of these people there. Because you really had this remarkable group of individuals, almost any one of whom could be their own book. They're that fascinating, right? And here they all are, this very unlikely assemblage of people duking it out over this, over the scenery. And how did they get there? And I became really fascinated by that. And I really wanted to put you in the minds of each one of these people. I wanted you to see the crazies through their eyes. And I found as I was writing, and it just sort of developed on its own, putting comments in quote marks and taking a kind of distance was creating too much of a wall. I wanted to create something that was more immersive, that almost, that put you right in their thoughts. And so when occasionally the book will go into sort of the language of, say, Rick or Alfred or Russell Gordy, and the words that they are using are words that they have actually spoken. I'm not making anything up. It's all from, there is a record for every single thought attributed to somebody. And yet I felt that it brought a certain immediacy to just lose the quotation marks and just plunk you right in there. And also, I wanted it to read like a great piece of fiction, even though it is scrupulously researched and fact-checked to within an inch of its life. I wanted it to have the kind of immediacy of a great page-turner novel.
Amy, I want to pivot a bit and return to a point or to a people you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, and that's the Absalican Nation, the Crow people. We've talked at this point mostly about the white settlers who occupy this land now. I'm curious about the consideration, or what consideration, as you were privy to it, what consideration did they give to the native histories of these landscapes? I feel like this is part and parcel of the environmental consideration conversation that we've had, but talk about that consideration, or the lack thereof.
You cannot talk about this land without talking about the people who were displaced from it, who were exiled from it, pushed off it to a reservation 200 miles to the east. And, the crazies are a sacred place for the Absalika people. What struck me was how little that got talked about with the current landowners. Rick Jarrett, I was once asking Rick if he'd ever found any, bison kill sites or artifacts. And he said, no, this was land nobody really lived in. And of course, that's not true. There were all kinds of stories that unraveled right on his ranch. And what made this conflict, what gave it a kind of turbocharge for me, was that at the same time that you have these landowners engaging in their elevated turf war, at the same time that's taking place, you have another fight that's going on, which is the Absalika struggle to regain some access to these sacred mountains, which are now, for the most part, private property. Crazy Peak is the private property of a private equity billionaire who likes to heliski on his own mountains. And they are struggling to get access to climb Crazy Peak as their ancestors did. And, I feel like you really can't talk about one without talking about the other. And in a plot twist that I could not have invented, the owner of Crazy Peak happens to be the private equity founder of a large private equity firm that owns the company that wants to build the wind farm in the crazies. So you have, for lack of a better word, the king of the crazies, the one who's sitting at the very, very top of the highest mountain of the crazies, is presiding over this, or is watching this whole conflict unfold in a kind of Wizard of Oz-like way. And he is engaged in his own ongoing negotiations with Shane Doyle, who is a Crow advocate and activist, and has been speaking up for Indigenous people and Crow country and Indian country more generally for his entire professional life. And he's trying to negotiate some deal to get permission for Crow people to climb Crazy Peak. And the attitude that that the owner of Crazy Peak takes toward this is very, on the one hand, very, you know, munificent. It's the least I can do. Of course, we'll work something out. But he's also, you know, well, they better bring their tribal ID and they better call my ranch manager first. And how come I haven't gotten a thank you note from the Crow tribe yet? He's disgruntled that there has not been some formal recognition of his decision to allow this access. So it's a very, it is a whole other dimension to this story that gives it just so much added depth because, you know, when you talk about the displacement of longtime ranching families, that's one kind of tragedy. But underlying all of that is this profound trauma and collective loss of an entire group of people, of a land and a way of life that was central to them. So it's, you know, there's a lot going on there.
Did you, Amy, know the role that the Crow people would play in this story before you began putting this book together? What kind of consideration did you give to their displacement?
I knew almost from the beginning that the Crow were a huge part of the story. I didn't perceive the connection. It took me a while to put the pieces together. I knew that you couldn't talk about who lives in the crazies without talking about who they displaced. I knew that for a fact. But then when I started reading about Shane's work and about the larger issues and the conflicts over access to the mountains and what they represented to people, I realized that was an absolutely central facet of this story. And in fact, one of the main protagonists in this story becomes directly involved in all of that. And I think it was a newspaper headline that caught my eye about some cabins being airlifted or airdropped by Chinook helicopter by the side of a remote glacial lake, and how the Crow Historic Preservation Officer and some other people had written a letter to the newspaper saying, you know, we're extremely concerned about this. Like, what happens next? And in fact, the owner of that cabin is one of the people in the book. So it does all come together. There is an extraordinary kind of overlapping of people and interests, and it even goes back in their histories. I began to feel almost like this was a three-dimensional puzzle.
You've been listening to the second half of my conversation with journalist Amy Gammerman, author of The Crazies, The Cattleman, The Wind Prospector, and A War Out West, out now from Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. To listen to this conversation again, or to listen to the first half of my conversation with Amy, head to mtpr.org. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.